Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Chicago Homburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the American Centrum in Homburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola, and today we're going to talk about the Democratic National Convention of 2024 in Chicago. We're not going back. With me today are Charlotte Lurg and Gary Kissick, whom you remember from our episode about the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Welcome, Charlotte and Gary.
Thank you.
Hi, good to be here again.
Great to have you. Charlotte teaches North American History and Transatlantic Studies at the Ludwig Maximilians University of Munich. She has published on the 19th and 20th century, including the history of universities, Americans in Europe, and the Cultural Cold War. Charlotte wrote a textbook in German on the American Revolution, and her current work focuses on visual knowledge and memory, as well as public history and media history in the 20th and 21st century. And she just finished teaching a course on the 1968 convention in Chicago, or is it still ongoing?
No, it finished. It finished. They're writing their papers. They're writing
how
their
did it
papers.
Go?
So we'll see how that goes. It went really well. I mean, you have to ask the students for the other side. But we had some good discussions. It's a complicated topic for German students to wrap their heads around. But I think it helped particularly for our final discussion that there was this sort of current affairs link that we could sort of jump.
Okay, on. And Gary Kissick is a poet, a novelist, and a University of Maryland professor emeritus of English, a past winner of both the Pacific Poetry Prize and the Honolulu Poetry Prize. His honors have also included a National Endowment for the Arts Creative Writing Fellowship and a Penn Syndicated Fiction Award. As you remember, he was one of the anti-war protesters who experienced the brutality of the Chicago police in 1968. His article, My Riot, A Personal Account of the Chicago Police Riot of 1968, was just released on Medium.com, and his article, The Notorious Electoral College and the Threat to American Democracy, can be found there as well. Gary now resides in the United Kingdom. So here we are looking at the Democratic National Convention held in Chicago in 2024 in August. I mentioned in the intro that we are not going back. Not going back is one of the slogans that was chanted most often by the delegates at the DNC. The meaning of the chant, not going back, refers to many things. It means not going back to previous restrictive policies on abortion. It means not going back on LGBTQ protections. It means not going back on racial equality issues, and it means not going back in general to the Trump era. But I want to use the phrase out of context now to describe my overall impression of the DNC, and that it did not go back to the chaos of the DNC of 1968. Sure, there are some similarities between the DNC of 68 and the one in 2024, but for the most part, they are insignificant. For example, in 68, the sitting president was Lyndon B. Johnson, and he chose not to run for election. He also chose not to attend the convention, and he is partly to blame for the intra-party chaos that followed, I would argue. In 2024, President Biden also chose not to run. However, he did attend the convention, and he offered robust support to his vice president, Kamala Harris. So while the 68 convention and the nomination of Johnson's VP, Hubert Humphrey, succeeded in fragmenting the Democratic Party, the outcome of the 24 convention seems to be one of party unity and coherence. Humphrey lost to Nixon, of course, so we'll see if Harris can beat Trump. Another difference in the two conventions is the nature and character of the protests. The 68 protests centered on opposition to the war in Vietnam, and were violent and chaotic, as we saw in our previous episode. The Gaza protests this time around were fairly small and tame by comparison. And just so you know, I'm recording this from Chicago, and Thursday I was downtown Chicago, not for the protest, for other reasons. But as I was leaving downtown, I did see about 20 Gaza peace protesters returning on the L, presumably from a protest downtown. But again, there was no violence or no disruption that I saw when I was here in Chicago. So the Gaza protests were nothing like the anti-Vietnam War protests of 68. But curiously, one similar protest group was there, which we remember from the last episode. Gary, you told us about the Poor People's Mule Train in 68. And indeed, in 2024, the Poor People's Army conducted several peaceful protest marches, which highlighted the plight of the poor people of the United States. In short, the DNC in 24 did not look back to 1968 in many different ways. So it was not going back. Charlotte and Gary, what were your main takeaways from the convention? And maybe Charlotte, let's start with you.
Yeah, I watched it with a certain amount of awe, as I always watch American politics when it goes full show business. In a way that I think particularly for European observers or maybe the German listeners to this podcast can relate. It is always interesting to see the staging, to see the spectacle, I'm going to use that word, that is being put on. The passionate speeches, the emotions that are on display, which particularly Germans in politics are usually a lot more reserved about.
For historical reasons. I just
for a good reason, yes, obviously. But in that particular context, it's always interesting to see these events also through that lens and to think about the kind of planning that went into this. And from this perspective, I think this was impressive on different levels because it was a very short period of time that they had to put this together. And they really managed to create, I haven't watched every 8 hours every day, I have to admit. I've watched a lot of it, but not a sort of gavel to gavel coverage. But yeah, it had a lot of very different elements that could relate to a broad amount of people. And at the same time, it still felt unified. And you mentioned earlier this we're not going back to the discord, the disunity. And while you could see there were different interest groups within the party, you could also see that there was a kind of unity, even if it's just the unity to beat Trump now, but I think it was more than that. And I felt that was quite impressive and also impressively on display. The other element that I found interesting was this emphasis on joy. I mean, they talked repeatedly about the politics of joy as their new perspective. And it's such a poignant counterpoint to the politics of hate. And obviously that's what they're going for. But again, I think it worked. It really created an atmosphere. And I wasn't there, and I can't tell if it was like that in the actual location. And if it will carry, that's the other question. But watching it in front of my computer screen, this joy carried, and that's pretty impressive all the way across.
Yeah, and I must say, being just in the city of Chicago for the end of the convention, that there was a vibe in the city just because 50,000 delegates were there, and you could see there was quite a bit of, I don't know, it's hard to say, but there was this vibe that Chicago was the center of the world. And that people were really happy. All Chicagoans were happy, and the people who came to visit were happy and joyful, and the weather was fantastic too. Gary, what were your main takeaways?
I totally agree with Charlotte. Joy did seem to be a theme, so much so that I wondered if people who spoke were told to please use the word joy in your speech, because it came up quite a bit. But it was a joyful and I think very well organized conference, and certainly a lot more lively than the Republican convention. I thought that the Democrats succeeded in really recapturing patriotism, because the GOP for a long time now has been passing itself off as the patriotic party, and somehow Democrats are not patriotic, and they certainly expressed patriotism very well. They had a number of veterans who spoke and had support. They had lots of American flags. A lot of people were surprised to hear the chant USA in a Democratic convention. Apparently there were some camo hats as well. I didn't see those, but some Republicans were complaining about this. Hey, they're taking
monopoly on patriotism or something.
Yeah, exactly. Our monopoly on patriotism.
The camo hat was a reference to the presidential candidate Tim Walz, who is a hunter. So
okay.
Hunters wear hunter caps, and that was some way of showing
right.
Kind of the rural and hunting credentials of many Democrats who are rural and hunting
sure.
folk who wear camo.
Okay. I also thought it was more vernacular than any past conventions I had seen. One example that really stood out for me was when Gretchen Whitmer said that Harris was tested, trusted, and badass. And I don't think you would hear the expression badass in any earlier conventions. I'd be surprised if you did. And the roll call with a disc jockey was certainly one thing that kept it from being a boring convention. And when you had Little John actually dancing down the aisle for Georgia,
his name is Lil John.
Lil John.
Lil John.
Lil John. Yeah. L-I apostrophe
John.
L. I'm just filling in the blanks there for people.
Okay. We're going to talk about grammar a little bit later.
I think we'll be getting into apostrophes, won't we?
Yes, we'll be getting into apostrophes. No, the certainly there was a feeling, an atmosphere, at least from what we saw on television, of joy inside the convention hall, and I would argue in the city of Chicago as a whole. But I want to go back to this point on patriotism, which then can take us into, I think, arguably one of the most important points of the convention, and that is this figure of Kamala Harris, who is a woman, and she is not white. And maybe, Charlotte, you want to talk a little bit about the significance of that, and also maybe the significance of the fact that she seems to be, and all of these speakers seem to be, kind of underplaying her feminineness and her non-whiteness, because it's, I think, a massive point that it will take us maybe months and years to fully understand. Charlotte?
Yes, this question is something that I've actually started observing even before the convention, that her campaign doesn't really make this a strong point in her sort of in the identity she projects, neither race nor gender, which I found interesting, particularly if we think to previous Democratic candidates. We had obviously Obama running as the first African-American president, and you had Hillary Clinton, who strongly emphasized this idea of running as the first woman. And some have argued that that certainly harmed her campaign even. So I think it's a very conscious decision to not make that the key point. But particularly based on that, I found it interesting how they still managed to make both of it very visible, not so much in Kamala Harris's figure itself, in her personality, but more in the convention as a whole. Like, you had a very diverse crowd, which was, I think, very visibly diverse in terms of age, in terms of race, in terms of gender identities, and so on. But it didn't feel, in a way, faked or staged. It felt organic. So that's one interesting element of this. And the other one is that obviously they invited in a way, they invited Hillary Clinton back to talk about the gender dimension so that Kamala Harris wouldn't have to. And she did a good job doing that. I mean, she really brought that home. And at least that's my view. And in a way, they have the vice presidential candidate taking on yet another issue that is usually associated as a sort of with his own personal history and with his family. And in a way, it also has this notion of reproductive rights in a different dimension. So they get the white men to cover that issue. And I just think that's such an interesting dimension to the whole campaign.
Yeah,
and
just,
I
know it's just taking... let's explain that story about walls that you just mentioned. I think our listeners might not be familiar with how that came about.
Yeah, so I just found, and he mentioned that in his speech in a very touching way, how he and his wife tried to get children, and they really tried for a long time, and they used, IVF, yes. And in the end, they had the daughter, who they called Hope. So obviously there is a very emotional story there, but it's a true story from his personal life. And the notion of IVF is something that's also under threat with this legislation against reproductive rights. So it's basically taking an issue that is one of the central issues, but turning it around and talking about it from that perspective. So I think that's something that's the whole campaign is doing. It's not just the convention, but I think that's interesting to see. There are a lot more points, but sort of Kamala Harris, and I think we might get back to that later, she's really presented more as the persecutor that she was rather than a non-white woman or a woman of color. So talk about her profession rather than that, than this sort of identity. And I think this particularly speaks to a younger generation who feel they want to move the conversation in a different direction. It doesn't mean that they don't acknowledge the difference and the diversity. It's not back to the colorblind notion, but it's a different kind of organic identity, I think, and that's what they're trying to do. I don't know if it's going to work. We'll have to see. But I think that was something that was very much on display in this convention, that all these dimensions seem to be there naturally, but you don't have to continue to go on about them, which obviously now we are doing. But
well,
no,
but the critical point that I think you made that we can emphasize here is that by having the other people talk about her gender and her racial and ethnic background, it frees her up to be the prosecutor in chief, as it were. And you made the good point about Val's talking about his own challenges with fertility, and that goes to the gender issue. But Michelle Obama then made the wonderful point about being a person of color, and this was the famous Black Jobs jibe, which was really good. And just so our listeners who might not know, Donald Trump recently said something at a campaign event or an interview that immigrants or illegal immigrants were coming to take Black jobs.
Yes.
Which was obviously not a well thought through comment, because it led to a number of responses. The American gymnast Simone Biles, who won the gold medal, posted something about being a gymnast, being a Black job, then with an emoji of her gold medal. And then Michelle Obama at the convention said someone needs to tell Donald Trump that he's applying for a so-called Black job, which got a mighty roar from the delegates there. And it was very funny. Gary, did you want to talk a little bit about gender or diversity? Or Charlotte, do you have another comment? Yeah, Charlotte.
Yeah, can I just follow up on Michelle Obama? Because her speech also had another element that I found really interesting in this context. And I think the Washington Post commented on that, so I don't want to take the credit here. But they highlighted the terminology that she used when she introduced this notion of affirmative action of generational wealth. And in a way, shifting that debate about affirmative action away from race and gender as well, and moving it back to class. And by doing so, being able to also attack Trump, of course. So I thought that was a genius move. And it really sort of also speaks to this more inclusive narrative that they are trying to convey.
Gary?
Well, I just wasn't sure why you were making a link between patriotism and gender and race.
Thanks for bringing me back to that. I did not make that clear, Gary. The idea of patriotism basically is the concept of who can be a patriot and how do we define who can be patriotic. And if the Republican Party wants to define that as being white and male, which they often do, the Democrats are trying to redefine that as basically anyone who is an American citizen.
Okay.
LGBTQ, non-white, female, whatever, also have status to claim to be patriotic and chant xenophobic chants like USA, USA.
Okay.
That was the point that I wanted to make, redefining what it means to be a good American citizen, a good patriotic citizen, as being anyone, not just a certain white man.
I've got you now. The first thing that leapt into my mind was that you might recall that they had some Republican speakers. And one who made the best impression on me was the former Georgia Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan. And he realized that he didn't have to convince anyone in the hall to not vote for Trump, but he directly addressed Republicans out there and independents, and particularly Republicans that are sick and tired of making excuses for Donald Trump. In his words, "The only thing left to do is dump Trump." And then he said, "If you vote for Kamala Harris in 2024, you're not a Democrat, you're a patriot." And I think that was a very important point. He was making it okay to be a Republican and vote for a Democrat because that's the patriotic thing to do.
Kinzinger made the same.
Kinzinger. Yep.
Made the same point. He basically retired and chose not to run again because he was a very strong anti-Trump Republican from the good state of Illinois.
Yep.
Now, people who are skeptical, knowing that Illinois is a Democratic state, thought that Kinzinger actually put on this super anti-Trump shtick because it's the only way he can ever get reelected or elected again in Illinois. But I actually personally believe that he's being quite genuine about this, and he's not doing it merely for his own political survival as a Republican in Illinois. But,
well, he was on the January 6th committee.
Yeah.
So I think that shows that he's sincere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he said the Republican Party is no longer conservative, and he wasn't the only one to make that point either. But he too raised patriotism. He said, "How can a party claim to be patriotic if it idolizes a man who attempted to overthrow a free and fair election?" And that's why you would be patriotic if you didn't vote Republican but voted Democrat. He said that Donald Trump has suffocated the soul of the Republican Party. And I think they did a pretty good job of making that point in the convention. As for her ethnicity, well, it's obvious. No one mentions that she's an Indian. No one says she's an Indian candidate, but she's just as much an Indian candidate as a black candidate. She did speak about her mother quite a bit in her acceptance speech. And a lot of people spoke about their mother. So there was really quite a bit of promotion of motherhood and the role of females in our society. Whether they raise families or whether they are childless cat ladies.
Oh, gosh.
And I loved, this may be a digression, but I loved the point Oprah Winfrey was speaking. And another point they were driving home forcefully was, it's okay if we differ in our politics. The important thing is that we're still a community, we still help each other. And the way Oprah Winfrey put it, you know, if a childless cat lady who has different views, if her house catches fire, by God, we're going to get together, we're going to go out there, we're going to try to save her, and we're even going to try to save her cat. Ironically, I don't know if you caught this, but the cameraman At that point, he focused on an obese black woman, really kept the camera on her for a long time, as if he knew that this was a childless cat lady, so much so that she turned around to see if he might be pointing at someone else. Was he pinpointing her? And sure enough, when she was interviewed later, she turned out to be both childless and to have two cats.
I thought, oh dear.
Rather amusing, if disturbing for her.
Okay, let's move on now to the European perspective. And one thing that struck me, and I think I always have to remind Europeans when I'm explaining the US elections to them, that Europe doesn't matter. It's a terrible thing to say, but when you watch 4 days of these conventions, you know, the Republican and the Democratic one, I think what non-Americans notice is how little world events matter in these conventions. And I would argue to American voters in general, besides some comments about supporting NATO or supporting Ukraine for maybe 1 second out of 24 hours, there's really no interest in talking about the rest of the world at all. So Charlotte, how does that make you feel?
Well, I don't demand or expect that. What I found interesting, and that's really what I mean maybe by this sort of international perspective. I mean, obviously, there's particularly transatlantic tensions are going to remain when it comes to economy and things like that. That's part of the process. And we know that the transatlantic relationship is really something that that is very low on the agenda if it's not within larger contexts like NATO or something like that, or now the war in Ukraine. But what I found interesting, and that in a way ties back to this reclaiming of patriotism, that there were some undertones of America is also going to be more of a leader in the world again. This idea going away from America first, even though obviously America still comes first, but this notion of taking the lead again, which obviously particularly from a European perspective, but I can imagine from different perspectives of the world even more so, might feel a little interesting at least. And Germans are very conflicted about that, right? On the one hand, we know that without the US, particularly when it comes to security, there are some serious gaps in our security. But on the other hand, there has been this move, particularly in Europe, to become more independent of the United States. So there has always been this ambivalence in looking towards how is the US going to act. But I still think that this, particularly in the sort of, if we think of the major global conflicts that we are facing, including something like climate change, it's going to be important to have a United States that is willing to at least rise to the position that geopolitically they still need to fulfill for now.
Now that you mentioned the word climate, or the phrase climate change, it just occurred to me, I didn't hear that much about the climate at all in this convention. Do you remember hearing anything about it? Besides just a word or two here and there, I mean, there is no significant focus on climate change, which I think the Democratic Party has realized is not a winning issue to run on anymore. As most European liberals have and progressives have realized too, that the sort of the green wave is subsiding. Okay, good. So, Gary, do you want to add something?
Well, just that Harris did speak about the right to clean air and clean water, and she did mention...
Just like Nixon in 68.
Yes. But she did tie that in with advocating policies that would help reduce climate change. But you're right, they didn't focus on it.
Gary, you mentioned Harris's speech. Why don't you talk a little bit more about the speech? What did you find interesting in that speech?
Well, I can address this question of foreign policy, which is true because foreign policy doesn't play well with Americans. But in her speech, she did address some foreign policy issues. She said she transitioned from having a fair immigration system to the importance of being a nation of immigrants. And then she said, we must also be steadfast in advancing our security and our values abroad. She talked about her role as a vice president in confronting threats to security and negotiating with foreign leaders and strengthening alliances. She said, and I quote, "As commander-in-chief, I will ensure America always has the strongest, most lethal fighting force in the world." You're probably happy to hear that. So,
yeah, it's the lethal that I was hesitant about.
We can kill if we need to. And then she talked about honoring our troops and their families, and another not so subtle dig at Trump when she said, "I will always honor and never disparage their service and their sacrifice. I will make sure that we lead the world into the future on space and artificial intelligence, and that America and not China wins the competition for the 21st century. And she wants to strengthen, not abdicate, our global leadership. NATO, of course, is the real issue for Europe, I should think. And Trump, she mentioned that Trump has threatened to abandon NATO and even encouraged Putin to invade our allies. He did it one time, say they could do whatever the hell they want if members of NATO weren't paying their fair share. And then she pointed out that she met with President Zelensky 5 days before Russia attacked Ukraine to warn him about their plan to invade. And she organized, mobilized a global response, over 50 countries, to combat Putin's aggression. So she pledged to stand strong with Ukraine and our NATO allies. She was pretty clear about that. Now, the really difficult one is, what do you say about Israel and Palestine?
Mm-hmm.
The United States appears to have taken both sides, standing by Israel and yet delivering aid to Palestine. So she said, she made it very clear, "I will always stand up for Israel's right to defend itself, and I will always ensure that Israel has the ability to do that, because Israel must never again face the terrorism that Hamas introduced." She spoke about unspeakable sexual violence and the massacre of young people at a music festival on October 7th. But then she said, at the same time, what happened in Gaza over the past 10 months is devastating. So many innocent lives lost, desperate, hungry people fleeing for safety. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking. So she ended that section of her speech by saying that she and President Biden are working to end the war, so that Israel's secure and the hostages are released and the suffering in Gaza ends. And the hard part, I think, the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination. Those are the words she used. That's quite a challenge.
Do you think she managed that balance appropriately?
In her speech?
Mm-hmm.
I think she did it as well as one could do, yeah. Do you?
Don't know.
Hmm.
I just know the strategy is to try to figure out some way of appeasing some people in her party, including many, many Jewish Americans who think that Israel has gone over the top in its punishment of the civilian population of Palestine, while also trying to fend off accusations from the right and from right-leaning Jewish Americans who are very concerned about any talk of the U.S. parting ways even a little bit with Israeli policy in general. So, I mean, she is in a tough position. I always thought that the fact that she has a Jewish husband gives her a little bit more freedom to shape how they want Israel to behave than any potential leader who didn't have a Jewish spouse, because certainly the accusations that Harris is anti-Semitic have been uttered, but are totally, totally inane. And I thought she did a good job responding to those accusations by just posting photos of her kissing her husband, which is all that really needs to be communicated.
Yeah, it's
tough. I mean, I don't... happy I don't have her job. Charlotte, what do you think? I saw you making notes on the Gaza issue.
I thought she handled it quite well in her speech, because if she hadn't said anything to that effect, she could have destroyed a lot of the bridges that they have been starting to build. And I mean, in a way, you have to see in that particular case, you have to see her speech in connection to Biden's speech earlier on in the convention, where he talks about the things that they are doing and that is going on, trying to find a possibility that brings peace. And I think particularly within the current situation, bringing the hostages back and finding a way to peace is as much as you can promise at this point. I mean, that's anything else would have sounded impossible and maybe insincere. So I think that's as much as far as they can go. But at the same time, if she had said less, particularly on the Palestine issue, I think, and on how they also attempt to bring Palestine into the conversation, she could have lost some of the non-aligned supporters that at that point were outside of the convention and were protesting, and have since, I think yesterday, said that they will align with her, but on the condition that she continues to work in that direction. So I think, like you said, is as good as she could handle it in the current situation.
She doesn't say that she believes in a two-state solution, but if I were to read between the lines, I think she probably does, and that means Netanyahu would have to go, because he's never going to accept a two-state solution. So I can see why she couldn't get into any more detail than she did in her speech.
I think the magic word she used there is the self-determination. Yes. It's historically, yeah. I mean, going all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, if you will, this idea of the 14 points is like saying it without saying it, right? And I think that's certainly something that at least that's something that struck me, that she used that terminology.
I totally agree with you on that.
My other cold objective viewpoint of this is that the best thing that could happen for the Harris campaign in the coming 2 months would be to see the hostages returned, including the American hostages, of course, and to see a ceasefire. That would be, I think, that would help her quite a bit. Not sure that's going to happen, though, because time is running low on the campaign. We talked a lot about a number of speeches. We talked about Oprah and Kinzinger. Were there any significant moments in any of the other speeches that you would like to mention?
For me, a speech I kept going back to was when Reverend Al Sharpton, he introduced four members of the wrongly accused Central Park Five, now the exonerated five.
Can you just tell our audience who these people were?
Yeah, they were five black youths from Harlem who were convicted of raping and murdering a white female jogger in Central Park at night.
Was it in the 90s, I think? The 80s or 90s? I think it was the 90s, anyway.
Yeah, I can't tell you exactly when. So four of them were there, and Corey Wise is the one who I think was tried as an adult. And if you've ever seen When They See Us, the final episode, it's a four-part show, focuses on what happened to him in Rikers Island and Attica. And one other prison, and he was really, truly brutalized. They don't come right out and say that he was raped, but it wouldn't surprise me if he was. So he spoke first. The Reverend Sharpton, who stood by them the whole time, saying they were innocent, he introduced them, and he spoke first. He spoke falteringly, and he said that Trump spent $85,000 on a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for their execution, which is true. He said, we were innocent kids, but we served a total of 41 years in prison. And then Yusuf Salam, who's now a New York City councilman, said that despite DNA evidence supporting the confession of the actual killer rapist, Trump still stands behind the original guilty verdict. He dismisses the scientific evidence rather than admit that he was wrong. And I'm quoting him here. He says he has never changed and he never will. And I thought that was a quite powerful attack on Donald Trump. There were a lot of subtle attacks on Trump. This was quite direct. Charlotte, I'll let you introduce a speech.
There were many to choose from.
I would
also say that was a powerful moment. I also thought it was interesting, and you mentioned that before, Andy, that there were so many military men speaking. There were quite a few sort of people who talked a lot about their army activities, including I don't remember the name, but the representative who was in charge of the campaign to get Osama bin Laden. So they really try to link that back to that as well, which I thought was interesting. I'm not entirely sure what I think of this choice, because there's a lot of debate about that whole process anyway, but I think it goes back to what you talked about earlier about how there's also this attempt to create this image of military strength for the Democrats, who traditionally have been sort of seen as the less military one. So getting Walz as the VP, I think also plays into that. So I thought it was interesting to make that choice, but then I have to admit that maybe some of that of me sort of really picking up on these military vibes is the European perspective again, because it's always something that is very unfamiliar to me. So I thought that was something that I found interesting. In terms of some of the other speeches, I already mentioned the Hillary Clinton speech, which I thought was very well placed. And also I thought it was interesting in the respect that she managed to not sound disappointed that she didn't make it. I know that sounds horrible, but it's the kind of thing, I mean, it was so close, and she ran against Trump and she knows what it's like. And now she's there supporting another woman doing this. And I thought she succeeded in not making it weird. I know that sounds a bit mean maybe, but that's something I thought was interesting. And interesting because we talked about Harris' speech. And one thing she did is when she talked about her mother and about all the people that helped raise her, in a way, she referred back to this notion that it takes a village. So there were these weird connections that I thought were interesting, and that maybe not everyone picked up on. But as someone who's been looking at sort of these themes also academically, that was definitely something that struck me. And finally, also I think as an assistant governor, Nessel, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right.
Yes.
Who was talking about gay marriage, and she had this this quote about her wedding band having to be plowed from her dead cold hands. So sort of linking that back to the quote about gun rights.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think there were a lot of these, let's call them throwbacks from like as you have them in sort of show business again, which I think gave the whole, it goes back to this idea that the whole show really felt like something that was in unison and in connection and interrelated, and I felt that really brought this message home on a different level than just the content of the speeches as well.
Good. Gary, final chance to talk about one of the other speeches, if you wanted to highlight anything else.
Okay, well, there were three very short speeches by people who were affected by the abortion ban in the southern states. Hadley Duvall spoke of being raped by her stepfather after years of sexual abuse and learning when she was 12 years old that she was pregnant. And she said she was surprised to find that she had a choice, and presumably she chose an abortion. But in many southern states, abortion is no longer an option for a rape victim. And then Caitlin Joshua spoke of being turned away from two emergency rooms when something didn't feel right while she was expecting her second child. And because of Louisiana's abortion ban, neither hospital would confirm that she was showing all the signs of a miscarriage. She was in pain and bleeding so badly that her husband feared for her life. Presumably, she miscarried safely. She didn't actually say what happened, but she did say that many women are afraid to tell even their doctors that they're miscarrying. And she said, "Our doctors deserve better. America deserves better." So these were other speeches by non-politicians that I thought really added great depth to the convention. And as a teacher, I always say, don't make generalizations, but provide specific examples to support your generalizations. And they did. They provided plenty of examples.
Okay.
Can I just say one thing about Walz? I probably shouldn't even mention this, but I have a Republican friend, I have a couple, who lives in Minnesota, and she's totally against Walz. And the reason is because of, correct me if I get his name wrong, but there was the murder by police of a black man named, was it George Floyd?
Yes.
Okay. And she criticized him for waiting 3 days to bring in the National Guard. She said, looters and arsonists just destroyed Minneapolis, and she's never forgiven him for that. I should think that would be a Republican talking point if they want to attack him.
I think they're already
too busy
doing
making
that.
Fun of his children. But yeah.
Yeah, I have heard them say that, though. But it would...
You have heard that?
I've heard that criticism, but I think they would make themselves quite vulnerable if they took that to argue against him, because I mean it would put the emphasis back on the Floyd murder. And
we're in favor of law and order as long as it means keeping blacks in line. Yeah, it was interesting that that she as a prosecutor convicted those who were sexual abusers, and yet they had Bill Clinton make a speech.
I heard an interesting commentary about this, I think, from The Atlantic, where a journalist had been talking to young Democrats, very mm-hmm. young, sort of those who have just come of age, who would probably have come of age in the context of the Trump-Clinton race. Mm-hmm. And for them, the Clinton they know is Hillary Clinton, and they know very little about Bill Clinton. They may
Let's keep it that way.
They may know what happened, but they were talking about that, and I think that's also indicative of something else that this convention has shown, is that this rejuvenation process that the Democrats were talking about after the Trump election, that this is necessary, that this is something they need to do, is now starting to take shape. And I don't necessarily just mean the rejuvenation in terms of Biden having stepped down in favor of Harris, but also in terms of who's active in the party, who's shaping, shaping the narratives. And I'm not saying we should forget about what Bill Clinton did, by no means. And I think there's a Netflix series that is just reminding even the younger generation of it, but it shows the direction the party is going as well in terms of age range as well. So that might be something that could be relevant come November.
Good. And let's talk about November now. because we do have to wrap it up. Do either of you want to go on the record making any predictions about the election? I know I refuse to because I've been burned before, but Gary or Charlotte, want to make any bold predictions about the election?
Okay. I predict that Kamala will win and will win big.
There you have it. Charlotte?
I don't want to jinx it.
We won't say.
Oh, God.
Okay. And the second important polling question, and this goes to grammarians in our listenership. Gary, you've taught English your whole life. Are you spelling the possessive form of Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S apostrophe, or H-A-R-R-I-S apostrophe S?
I'm going to add an apostrophe S because of the sound. This is the way I've always learned it. If her last name was Connors, we wanted to talk about her policies, you would say Kamala Connors policies. You just put an apostrophe after the S. But you wouldn't say Kamala Harris policies. You'd say Kamala Harris's apostrophes, and that's why I would put an apostrophe S.
Thank you, Gary. Charlotte, you want to weigh in?
Well, I'm not a native speaker, and I'm thankful for the S, because anything else is just confusing.
So apostrophe S. Good. All right. Thank you. There you've had it. The style guide. Now we know how to do this. And I know how to write my show notes for this now. Very good. Gary, Charlotte, thanks again for sharing your insight about the DNC in 2024.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Yes.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.